listen till my horse tired through darts and balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland. The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 2. Up into the sky, down into the ground. To the side of the Embers' cabin was a small garden patch of spinach and potatoes. It was enclosed by a rickety fence mobbed with weeds and the shiny knobs of pink and orange swamp flowers, while everything outside the garden smelled like skunks. Inside the garden patch itself, there was a restful fragrance of mint and lilac. On this ghostly night, Kittery sat in the garden beside Paul, an ancient and rumpled pear tree, waiting for the moon to rise. Snug around her shoulders was a blue blanket named Sky. At her feet, the yellow flames of a small campfire. Her eyes drifted hopefully from the fire to the faraway frosted ridge, while Paul, the pear tree, looked more like a broken umbrella being strangled by a rotten trench coat. He was still very much alive, the green evidence tangled from his shadowy jacket, the limey bulb of a fresh pear. According to rule number 7, the fruit rule, she called it, it was Kittery's job to monitor any nearby growing fruits and pick them before they fell. The only fruit tree the Embers had was Paul, and Paul had only enough strength to produce the occasional pear. He also had a terrible habit of weakness. His old wooden fingers simply could not help but fumble the delicious fruits before they'd fully ripened. So Kittery, every afternoon, would climb atop an old milk crate and give Paul's pear a tug. Of course, it wasn't as simple as that. Before approaching the pear tree, she'd announce, "I'm coming to check on Paul's pear," which warning resulted in a feathery explosion as Wizzywig the woodpecker dashed free of Paul's black branches. Paul was named Paul and Wizzywig Wizzywig because of rule number 32, the naming rule. It was one of Kittery's favorite rules so far, and it went like this. Of the things unnamed you meet each day, bestow a name and thereafter say. She named the mouse and the wall near her bed King Dossy Sissy Saw-Saw. She named her pencil Whistle. Her notebook was called Mr. Curious. A pleasant side effect, Kittery's father sometimes called her the president of Paul's pear. With the arrival of rule number 10, on paper with pencil each day, write down the remarkable, come what may. It was soon her afternoon hobby to write in her diary beneath Paul, with her favorite blanket wrapping her shoulders. Thus, it was not unusual for Mr. and Mrs. Embers to hear Kittery say something entirely bizarre, like this. The president of Paul's pear is taking Whistle, Sky, and Mr. Curious out to visit Paul, which had also been the first thing she'd written down in Mr. Curious. This had set the tone for subsequent entries. The homemade language was her own secret code, and it kept the contents of her diary all but incomprehensible to anyone but herself. The fire was dying, the moon not rising, and Kittery drew Sky tightly around her shoulders. High above her, The real sky was a silken garment of yellow stars and faint, silvery production. Kittery sighed impatiently. The stubborn moon was still packing its white bags on the far side of the mountains. Mr. Embers stuck his head through the kitchen window. "Any sign yet?" he asked. The question itself meant she didn't have much time left. He didn't like her staying out late, even if Rule Number 81 recommended such astronomy. "Quinella is stuck," Kittery pouted. She pointed to the billowing snow of light building behind the ridge. "What's a quinella?" her father asked. "The moon, Daddy. Just one more minute," she laughed. And then, suddenly serious, she stared at her dirty wrist as though she wore a watch. A moment later, her father strolled along the garden path. He was doing his casual walk, humming and peeking around the potato mounds as though he didn't have a care in the world. Of course, this meant he was on a mission. He wanted to get his daughter to bed. "Almost time," he whispered, his quiet voice meant to take the sting out of such bad news. He handed her a cup of warm milk and shifted the heavy rucksack on his back. She could not argue directly with him. If she begged for more time now, he'd end the evening instantly. He was like that. But he could be tricked. Kittery had learned that indirect routes were often the most effective. Enigmatic Rule Number 17 had said as much. "Don't move the mountain stone by stone. Just turn around and pretend it's gone." "Daddy, why do you always wear the rucksack?" she asked. A familiar question, but he'd never given a satisfactory answer. "I've lost a good bit of weight," he said. "It's quite heavy and sturdy and lets me walk around more easily." He demonstrated this ease, going down the row of spinach and back. It was the dull answer he always gave. She sipped the milk and felt at the warmth of the tin cup. "But why?" she asked. "I don't wear a rucksack, and I walk around, and I'm lighter than you." Mr. Embers undid the chest strap of his rucksack and struggled down low beside her. "Well," he began, "as we've told you, your mother and I have to follow our own rules. We have our own rule books. That's why we came here in the first place, to the swamp. That's why I wear the pack, and we have a lot of other rules to follow. And one of them is that no matter how hard it might be, or how much we might wish it, we can't tell you what the future holds. We can't tell you what's happening to us. Most of it we don't know ourselves anyway." "But what would happen if you told me?" Kittery asked. "I don't know, Kittery," he said. "I wish I could tell you about the rucksack, about why I need it," her father continued, "and about the anchor, the wheelbarrow, about your mother and what's happening with her. But until then, it's a lot like Rule Number 3. Don't peek ahead at the next day," she said glumly. Mr. Embers pulled her to him. "We don't need to know some things," he said. "That's exactly how the world works. Like with Paul's pear. As president, you don't need to know exactly when it will fall. If you knew, perhaps you'd never check. You'd just wait a few weeks, and then right before it fell, you'd go out and catch it. And then you wouldn't get to be such a good friend of Paul's, would you? He might not even be the president of his pair." He tickled her, and she laughed. They sat together for a short while, before the dwindling flames, waiting for Quinella. Soon, however, Mr. Embers sat forward, about to call an end to the evening. "Play a song?" Kittery suddenly suggested, another delaying tactic. He fastened the strap of his rucksack and stood. "One song, and then bed," he offered. Kittery smiled her agreement, and Mr. Embers rattled off. A moment later, he returned, holding his guitar before him like a great wooden spoon. He peered around the spinach patch for a comfortable place to play. It wasn't easy to strum a guitar with a great pack on your back. He spotted a milk crate. As he sat slowly down upon it, his backpack crunched into Paul's lower branches. She watched his fingers, first the fingers that held the strings, and then the fingers that played them. He had taught her a number of these songs, and the tips of her own fingers were getting coarse. All of her father's songs had an air of mystery, like something a fortune teller would whisper in your ear, a secret truth about yourself, about everyone, about the world. Her eyes blurred. She was tired. But even as her eyes began to close, a thin worry formed. There was something not right in the garden. She could see it. It was right out there in the open. But her sleepy brain couldn't exactly tell her what it was. Through half-closed lids, she peeked around the dark patch. Her father singing in the orange light, Paul behind him in the darker flickers, Quinella sleeping in the far valley. But something was definitely wrong, and it was right there in front of her eyes, eyes that were soon too tired to stay open.
Unbuckle the sun, slip on the old moonlight. A basket of stars, blanket of velvet night. And I hope we come this way again, 'cause I'll take the moon for my best friend. But I'm inside out whenever she arrives. Unbottle the birds, sing in the sun's delight. In a garden of blue, carnation clouds take flight. And I hope we fly this way again, 'cause I'll take the sun for my best friend. But I'm inside out with life when he arrives. Up in the hills, let's you and me abide. The rocks and the dirt and the pine needles sure come by. The hills are all horses, now everything can ride. And I hope we ride this way again, 'cause I'll take you my best friend, but you're inside out with song, and so am I. And I hope we ride this way again, 'cause I'll take you dear for my best friend, but you're inside out with song, and so am I.
At night, great glass cover seemed to lift from the swamp. Fresh cold air tumbled in from the mountains. There was a rain song of crickets and tree frogs, and the entire swamp was refreshed by a fragrance of sweet fires and the emerald salt of the faraway ocean. Darcy had been there all along, first tucked behind the necklace of grey stones that circled Paul, and then, as Mr. Embers began to sing, he'd skittered around the garden patch to be closer to Kittery. By the end of the song, Darcy, like Kittery, had fallen asleep where he sat. Mr. Embers set his guitar against Paul's main branch and lifted Kittery into his arms. As he did so, her blue blanket slipped to the ground, falling right on top of Darcy. The little mouse, snoring in a bed of spinach, turned happily at the accidental tucking in. Inside the cabin, Mr. Embers lowered Kittery down on her mattress and swooshed the cool blankets over her. "Daddy," she said in a drowsy voice. "Yes," he replied. "I saw something in the garden." "What was it?" he asked. But her sleepy brain still couldn't figure it out. Mr. Embers kissed her forehead. "We'll talk about it in the morning," he said. But she held on to the suspicious image of her father playing his guitar, seated on the milk crate, the yellow fire, the rucksack crunching into Paul. Her eyes shot open. That was it. She sat up and the covers flopped to her lap. in Paul's branches. Wizzywig. The woodpecker had been standing there all along in the shadowy sticks. But why hadn't he flown off? It didn't make sense. The woodpecker was terrified of her. How could it not be frightened of her father and his big, noisy rucksack pressing in at him? She scanned the darkened shapes of the single-room cabin. The family fire was out. No candles were lit. But a rule book glowed in the corner cubby in a milky light. The loops of the leather strap that tied her diary to the rulebook put a ribbony shadow on the wall, over the window, a rubbing of chalk dust. "Quinella," she whispered out loud. The moon had finally risen. She stood cautiously, holding her breath. Her father had a special ability to sense any secret outing. She took a few soft steps, creeping past her parents' bedroll. Her thumb muffled the door latch as she turned herself out into the cold air. There were two missions. One, following the dictates of Rule 81, observe the moon. Number two, check on Wizzywig. Maybe the bird was sick. Maybe it wasn't him at all, but some collage of sticks and leaves that just looked like a woodpecker. All around her was a quiet roar of night, as though some box of fresh silence had been broken open. Quinella was high and grey and glistening, a newspaper cutting soaked in wet light. Kittery shivered down the garden path until her feet kicked over the soft fuzz of sky. She lifted the blanket up. Darcy lay on his back, a long spinach leaf curled around his middle. His little eyes darted wide with the loss of his comfort. "What are you doing out here?" Kittery frowned. Darcy squeaked. He couldn't remember. Not anything. Where he was, what was happening. "You should be in your hole where it's safe," the little girl said. She formed her hand into a gentle claw and dropped him into her dress pocket. Though the fire was out, she sat in her former spot. The campstones were still warm as she set her feet against them. When she was ready, she looked deliberately into the place where Wizzywig had stood, or seemed to, just behind her father. He wasn't there, nor did the sticks or leaves create the illusion of his shape. She lay back on the garden path and pulled Skye to her chin and stared deeply at Quinella's frosted crests, at the inky paper surface of the moon. Was there something special she was meant to see? Was there a point in all this? A black shape shot across the milky stars, an enormous bird swooping in the wind. "There's Wizzywig," she whispered to Darcy. She didn't know if woodpeckers ate mice, but Wizzywig and Darcy had had a few run-ins. She'd sometimes come into the garden to find the large bird standing over the mouse, ready to pounce. As the bird stalled against the breeze and drifted back, Kittery changed her mind. Wizzywig was a sharp bird, all angles and arrows, with a diamond-shaped head. This bird was blocky, almost rectangular, like a big floating cross. Maybe it was an owl, she thought, or even a hawk, maybe an eagle or falcon. A second bird, much smaller than the first, flew into view over the forest. By its crisp collection of angles, Kittery knew this was, in fact, a woodpecker. Wizzywig shot like a missile toward the larger bird, and Kittery cringed and braced for the impact. It was a curious collision. Wizzywig crashed against the other bird with a sudden gentleness. The woodpecker was not attacking. No, Wizzywig had landed on the blocky bird. He folded his wings behind him and then sidestepped to take a perch on the bigger bird's shoulder. Kittery stood and began to inch cautiously down the garden path, watching the two birds drift. At the urging of his whiskers, Darcy clambered out of her pocket and took up a position on her left shoulder. Kittery unhooked the fence rope and followed the glide of birds into the marshes. A long, creaking groan brought her to a halt. as though a dungeon door had slowly closed in the dark nettles ahead. She froze and listened. The dungeon door remained quiet for a moment, and then began to whine again. At the urging of his whiskers, Dossie jumped into the air and came down hard on her shoulder, claws out. "I hear it, Dossie," she whispered. She folded her legs and crouched low to the ground. Dossie leapt again. He was very close to giving her a little bite. "Go home," he squeaked. Normally, she would have. But there was something strange about two strange things at the same time. She sensed a deeper consistency, a connection. If the two birds in the sky formed a kind of question, Kittery supposed, then the groaning sound in the nettles provided a possible answer. Dossie jumped a few more times, letting his claws tell the story of his whiskery terror. She put a hand over his body and shushed him, and then moved forward into the wet grass. She stopped when her shin struck a baggy boulder. She knew these fields well. Aside from grass and mud and scrubweed, they were empty. There weren't any logs or boulders or rocks. She reached a hand out from the blanket and felt the surface of the impediment. It was not a rock. It was her father's rucksack. Her face darkened. Birds in the sky. Her father's rucksack on the ground. Dossie was trembling and pinching down. The dungeon door groaned once more, and the moon-painted grass suddenly parted. Kittery gasped when she saw it, but one part of her already knew. In fits and starts, as though being pushed by a sleepy ghost, her father's wheelbarrow rolled into view. The heavy cargo of the anchor scraped in agony around the bucket. Dossie's whiskers shot in different directions, and he pumped up and down. Unable to control himself, he jumped away from her shoulder and landed in the dangerous bucket of the wheelbarrow as it swung past. He chirped and squeaked and ran for his life up the rusty anchor until his front paw touched the rope. The rope, which Kittery saw now, streamed darkly into the sky. Kittery stared at Dossie, at his paw, at the rope. The wheelbarrow growled at the dirt and then began to tip in a rush of wind. Kittery's eyes followed the line of the pointing rope into the starry sky, to where her father floated, high in the winds, above the swamp.
There's smoke in the forest where the forest ought to be. I ought to climb down this old burning tree, but I'm looking out the ocean, looking out to sea, but there's smoke in the water where my boat used to be, boat used to be, boat used to be. Now send my love a letter, said, won't you marry me, but she burned the letter up, now smoke's all I see. Always love my true love, but she don't love me, 'cause there's smoke in her heart in the place I ought to be, I ought to be, I ought to be. In the forest flows a river where the forest won't grow, and the cloud of smoke above is the river burn below. So some will go to heaven, some straight into the ground. Smoke and walk around, can walk around, can walk around. All she ever finds is forest, climbs up in my tree, sees the smoke rising up from the forest and the sea. Maybe I'm the smoke from the boat or the tree, but the smoke in her heart is the smoke I want. Ought to climb down this old burning tree, but I'm looking. There's smoke in the water where my boat used to be. Boat used to be. Boat used to be.
Kittery shouted to her father, called to him from the cold meadow grass. Kittery, he finally noticed her. It's all right. I'm coming. He flipped against the sky and struggled down the rope, hand over hand, his feet flopping in the stars. I'm coming, Miss Drembus called. But his voice was weak. A blast of wind rattled the leaves, and a moment later a heavy gust struck against Miss Drembus and ripped him like a terrible kite across the sky. The wheelbarrow spun madly and toppled, and the anchor swung out freely from the bucket. Dossie squealed as loudly as he could, and Kittery ducked as the anchor caromed overhead. Come down, Kittery shouted. She was stumbling through the grass. Behind her, from the cabin, came the thin report of a rifle crack. She turned, breathless, seeing nothing. The anchor barged, a wild bull through the nettles. Mr. Embers called again. Dossie, it's time, it's time. Take the rope. Kittery saw a gleam of sad silver in the sky, the blade of her father's buck knife shining in the light. Another rifle shot from the cabin, and Kittery spun on her heels. What's happening? She cried. A sinister orange light illuminated the cabin, as though her mother had somehow lit a fresh fire in the garden. The wind reversed and slowed, and Mr. Embers floated back overhead. The anchor drowsed along the grass. Her father was 30 feet above her now, a light rain of sweat dripping from his body. His breath was quick and short. The silver knife in his hand winked in the moonlight. Stop, she begged him. Go to your mother, Mr. Embers cried, and get your rule book. Another rifle crack and a deeper boom from the cabin. Kittery swung around, ice-cold tears on her cheeks. Dossie, Mr. Embers shouted. Her heart fluttered when she saw it. The knife had cut the rope in two. In each of her father's fists, a terrible bouquet of severed thread. Mr. Embers held on for a quiet moment until their eyes met, and then as calmly as he could, he said, I will see you soon, Kittery, my darling. I love you completely. Your mother and I both do. Follow the rule book. That's the best and only thing you can do. Do as your rule book says. Do you hear? Now turn from me and run for the cabin. Do not watch, Kittery. Do you hear? She forced her eyes to the ground and took a few steps. But when the anchor smashed into the dirt like the final thump of a monstrous heart, she couldn't help it. Her eyes ripped at the stars. But he was already gone, his faint, small shadow etched in the swallow of darkness and tiny lights. The breath died in her chest. Her thoughts dissolved in a grey disturbance. She choked. Dossie squeaked from the fallen anchor, and her feet sprang to life. She was running now, soundless, breathless, flying low over the grass for the safety of her mother. The wind screamed, and a rough curtain of smoke rose over the swamp. The ground shook hard once, and her right leg kicked into the left and sent her spinning to the ground. She lay for a moment on the earth, her hands clutching cold, damp mud. The wind was raging now, pushing her toward the cabin. Not only that, but a deep and watery force drew her onward. She was being dragged over the dirt. She dug her heels in and grabbed hold of the garden fence. Splinters and fire spattered all around. The cabin coughed with heat and then inhaled, reaching for her. There were stones in the air, branches, grit, cakes of mud beating small fists against her body. The garden rail broke free of the post and shot like an arrow through the kitchen window, and she rolled down the path, tumbling, grasping at the spinach, at the mounds of dirt. But everything was soft and shifting. Boards were breaking in the cabin, dishes smashing. A misery of red fire dripped from the roof. At the smashed doorway, she shouted for her mother. But her mother was gone. in her place, the painted black shadow of a deep hole in the floor. A tornado of dirt and fire spun a furious blitz over the terrible black drain in the earth. She flipped onto her belly and pressed herself into the ground. Her fingernails, her chin, her toes, all etching their resistance in the dirt. As her eyes peeked over the edge of the hole, she cried out again. 100 feet below, in the golden carnage, the tiny, impassive figure of her mother falling into the earth. There was nothing, nothing she could do, nothing that she wanted, but the safety of her father, her mother. She lifted her toes, her fingers, permitting it. Unable to tolerate the alternative, she began to tip forward into the hole. A biting line of tiny nails blasted over her wrist. It was Dossie. She flicked her arm to get free of him, but he held on tight, digging in with his claws, racing circles over her wrist, nails and teeth drawing blood. In his mouth, she saw it, the frayed end of her father's rope. Her body swept over the edge, and she fell, weightless, but only for a moment. Her shoulder shot away, exploding, as the rope bit down into her wrist. Dossie squeaked at the edge of the hole, and Kittery swung in the maelstrom of wind and fire and pebbles before she understood. Dossie had wrapped her wrist in rope, the rope still connected to the rusty anchor in the marsh. She dangled now from it, a spray of sand and sticks raining down on her. With all her might, eyes closed, with both hands, she pulled and kicked her feet against the dirt until she dropped forward onto the floor. For a moment, she fought to free herself of the rope, that she might turn herself back into the hole to be with her mother. But her mind, like a box of wind, escaped her, and her eyes closed, in shock, in sleep. When she woke again, it was morning. Birds sang. The wind blew gentle around her. Her body was knotted with cold, and she opened her cramped hands and slowly unwound the rope from her blistered wrist. From the hole there rose a trembling branch of black smoke. She rolled onto her back and stared at the blue sky. A small squeak roused her, and she swung her head around slowly, like a cow. Dossie was standing in the cinders. She climbed over her hands and stood, her body shaking. She stood on a black, burnt shadow of earth. The cabin was gone. Dossie squeaked again, and she limped toward him. He was standing on the only thing that hadn't gone shooting into the hole. Her hand dropped automatically down, and Dossie clambered up her cold arm. Her fingers caught against the loops of the leather strap, the strap which held the two books together. When she read the title off, it was as though a spell might be undone, that the sound of the silver letters on the cover might erase all that had happened. The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers, she said, and fell into weeping. I walked down the path through the woods, the falling snow, my neighbor. Black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down.